So what's the point of regaining the center? Obviously we feel more balanced, less pressurized, more complete. There's something also unknown about it. The center actually, it's got no name to it. You can't really, it's not certainly not a me, it's not an it. But there's a sense of, you know, things kind of come together in harmony, and there's a quality like an openness and a non-holding in it. We're not holding everything together, and we're not squeezing everything into some shape. It's just things. We can feel a sense of centeredness in our life, and this really is about the release from clinging, which is a force that we don't necessarily recognize. Because it's not something we necessarily do. Certainly you get possessive around, possessions, physical objects. When we make things into objects, we get possessive. But the problem is making things into objects in the first place. So that's already considered to be an error or a mistake. Well, surely there are such things as objects. Well, there are things that appear as objects, but everything is exactly itself. Yeah. So we see things, clocks and trees and rocks, you know. And what I see is rock, lump of compounded stuff I can tread on, and that's it, my mind. A tree, wooden stuff sticking up, you know, with leaves hanging off it. And then, of course, I might see it as lumber, I might see it as a weed, I might be a botanist and specialize in it. No, definitely, but the tree doesn't know anything about that. The tree's just treeing. It doesn't recognize itself as lumber or fruit tree, it's just treeing. Yeah. And you can see the very problem of this objectification is we see things as things that can be possessed. And then grasping supports some fairly unwholesome relationships. Yeah. So I see things can be exploited for my benefit. And human beings do this a lot. Yeah. And we see things like a particular kind of yellow metal, we call it gold. It's not that useful, actually. It's not very hard. It's not very durable. It's not very good as metal goes. It's just the stuff that appears in the earth, and we make this something of incredible value, in which we are quite prepared to, you know, desecrate, mine, poison, in order to get this stuff out, and then we get it out, and we stick it in a bank, where it's an object, you know, these vaults, maybe we knock some of it into jewellery. Yeah, that's called an object. And actually, the very nature of an object is something that we already determine as being something desirable, undesirable, usable, dismissible. And of course, this process gets extremely unpleasant when it comes round to living creatures. We also see as that, when does a creature become vermin? When is it a pet? When is it livestock? Yeah. You know, when is a sheep a nuisance and when is it a valuable commodity? The sheep's just sheeping. Okay, take it up another level, human beings. She's my cook. He's my driver. Right? Objectification. And all the subtler forms of it. Yeah. He's lower than me because he doesn't have the education or So we get objectification. It's called papancha, proliferation. It means we load, or there's a loading of meanings onto something rather than letting it speak for itself and be itself. And it's most obvious and most distressing when it comes to human beings, as we all would recognize, and recognize this process and the destruction that it causes. So what's happened? The grasping has made a graspable. And what that grasping has needed is a perception, that's an interpretation of something. Yeah. And that perception to be seen as the final reality of what the thing or the person is. You are what I perceive you as. Right? I can only see you in terms of my perceptions. So that perception is called an aggregate that's affected by grasping. Yeah. It's a kind of an interpretation or a kind of meaning that happens to me, and that attracts the wish to make things solid and final. And when it's like that, then I stand apart from it. That's that. I don't see it as something that's occurring in me, in my mind. I don't see my perception of you as occurring in my mind. I think it really is you out there. You know, I mean, I've got a little wiser over the years, but this is quite common. That's grasping. Yeah. And it's this that fills this agency, which we're not always that clear about. We can see the results of it. It fills that the center of our life, becomes chock-a-block with these perceptions. They create a solidity. Myself, others, my mother, my father, my boss, my son, and charged with all kinds of emotive significance. And they feel, how many people live in your head? How many people live in your heart? And what are they doing in there? And of course, then we naturally, this process also bounces back. I become a perception in my citta, in my mind, and heart. Yeah. And for that, I interpret certain behaviors, I have certain memories, and it gets established around that. Some of it, what people say about me, I grab hold of that. What I remember, grab hold of that. Worldly together, that's me. And it's quite surprising sometimes. Indeed, it's continually surprising. As generally the way when people express how they see me, I'm always surprised. generally quite positive, actually. And, okay, great, good for you. I don't really see myself that way, but I'm not saying I'm clear about it. I'm not saying I've got the truth. I'm not saying that my perspective of myself is unbiased and blemished. Generally, my perspective of myself is generally rather flawed by feelings of inadequacy and didn't get that right and can't do this properly. That's more likely that the kind of tonalities that affect how I conceive myself. Sort of average kind of person who bumbles along and collides with this, that and the other, and occasionally comes up with a few fluky nice points and then bumbles along some more, you know, and probably makes some mistakes along the way. That's roughly how I see myself. But I'm not saying it's true. But that's, you know, how do you see yourself? You have to say, you know, quick photo image of who you experience, what you experience yourself as. It's the quick one, just the quick immediate flash of probably, yeah, well-meaning person, made a few messes, don't quite get it, trying the best I can, something like that. Who's that? And that one can fill the centre. Now when that film fills the centre as a sense of what I am, then my actions, the actions that come from me, will come from tainted or biased by that particular perception. So often I find I'm actually, people say, you do so much. Well, I'm actually trying to make up for all the mistakes I'm committing. Something like that is a certain compensation against the inadequacy that I've experienced myself as. So I tend to try to do a bit more to compensate for that. And I say, oh, you do a lot. Some don't. Of course, some think I do nothing. Yeah. And that's not too bad, really. And compared with what I've heard other people express about themselves, as really quite tragic, actually, to feel so undeserving, so unworthy, such a miserable being, and experience themselves as being. Yeah. And then, you kind of, well, how's that? So it makes them faltering or trying to present themselves in a more positive light. And then you begin to get some of the histories of what shaped that perceptions, the lack of love, lack of warmth, lack of, nourishment, and so forth. And then, okay, we can't go back in the past, and we can't go back to make it otherwise, but we can recognize, this perception of myself, which can fill the center of my life, has to be not taken as the ultimate truth, but certainly taken as something to be responsible for and to practice with, to get some space around it, to get some goodwill around it, to get some air around it, to listen to it, in order that those gripped perceptions can release. Not that you don't have them, but they no longer weld together into something convincing. And I guess this is how it is. We carry particular shapes, impressions of ourselves, and one learns to live with it and not take it seriously, but you still have it, still can retain. And after a few more years of practice, those impressions of yourself get more muted, more subtle, more just dim echoes, and eventually there's not much of a perception of yourself at all. Emptying. The centre is regained by emptying it of the forms that occupy it. Forms, perceptions, feelings, sankharas, habits and attitudes and that fill it. I'm this kind of a person. I'm a do-it person, or I'm a can't-do-it person. So we get particular habits. And you need to challenge these habits. This is all grasped at. There's a grasped at called the grasped at aggregates. Okay. And then similarly to others as to myself. How do I perceive him, her, so on, and recognize. Perception is always got some truth in it, but it's pretty much a very partial reading. Yeah. There's always something there, and yet we'd never get the whole picture. I don't know. I don't actually know who you are. I don't really know who my parents were. I have certain perceptions. that have stayed, generally quite positive in my case. And once we don't know each other, it gives a lot more room to keep being with each other in this open, unfigured, responsive way. I don't actually have to know who you are, I just have to sense how I bring forth the most kind or supportive or clear or honest responses to what arises. Regaining the center is actually always unfigured, because this grasping wants to create a solid world and a solid person, it gets filled. Now, as we practice and meditate and develop and so forth, steadying and calming, the great releaser, the great liberator is called insight, which clearly you all heard of, well, imagine you all heard of. And it's not a technique. There are, systems and lineages that present vipassana techniques. But actually, at least the early teachings, it was not a technique. It's just something that happens. Like when you do some calming and do some steadying, and you do some healing, and you do some loving, and you do some, making chitta a little more open and less tense and reactive and oppressed, you see things clearly. You have insight into things, because the quality of clearing and opening and steadying the chitta begins to work against these grasped habits, grasped perceptions. And we're doing things like, body, breathing, silence, resonance, kindness, just energies and intonations and qualities that themselves are not fixed. Breathing is a flow, it's not an entity. Energy is a flow, it's not energy. Heart, loving kindness is a flow, it's not a thing. And we get used to that, and that flowingness and fluidity of walking, breathing, listening, chanting, blessing and so forth, shifts our experience of reality to be something that's actually innately, when you get to the real living intimate experience that's given to you, it is always flowing. That's life. Life is a flow. Even you say you see something, actually what you see in one second is slightly different from what you see in the next second. How your eye assembles shapes and colours and perspectives. It's constantly forming. Everything is in motion. As we get more used to that, the chitta comes out of its gripped, frozen, rigid state and stiffness or oppression to something that's got some space in it. It can move, it can flow. And as it becomes cultivated, you begin to notice actually what happens, what occurs to what are called dhammas, are not entities, they're events. They're micro events. They're not entities at all. There's the event of seeing. And each event is kind of coupled with other events. So seeing can only occur if there's both consciousness and an object, obviously. So we're consciousness and something that we can be conscious of. And then when consciousness arises, there will be some kind of perception. If there's no perception, we don't feel we've seen something. It's only when there's consciousness, a visual object, and that's that, that we get the sense of having seen something. Bear in mind, you've all had your eyes open a considerable amount of the day. Today, how much did you see? What did you see? You probably pass all kinds of bushes and shrubs. What did you see? Oh, a few trees. Yeah, some flowers. A frog. Cobblestones. What did you see? Did you see the grass? Oh, yeah, some grass. Could you say that you saw everything that your eyes detected? No, you didn't. You could list the clouds, the colour of the sky, the birds, the grasshoppers, the crickets, so-and-so, you know, so-and-so walking past. Yeah, so many things. But you actually just saw a package that actually, oh, you saw it because when your eye hit it, touched it, there was attention, right? You're actually attentive to it. So that's another factor, attention. Yeah. If we don't give attention, we don't see. Our eyes see, but our mind doesn't get it. Perception, oh, that's Joseph. Otherwise, it's just some shape. And that resonance. So that so-called object is made out of a series of micro-events kind of coming together for a moment. And then, if you get really accurate at it, Joseph at 10 o'clock is not the same as Joseph at 11 o'clock. And yet, we think it is. But his experience has shifted and changed. He's a different mood, different space, different energy. His mind's a different place. So, we're dealing with micro events. And being careful and aware of tendency to adopt them as fixed realities. This makes us take things for granted. Things become kind of half dead. We lose respect. It's just her again. We lose the sense of openness to who is she at this moment. We lose that sense of openness, and we see her as an object. We probably lose the sense, the recognition of, oh, just like me, she experiences aging, sickness, death. Just like me, she's born. Just like me, she experiences health and sickness. Just like me, she gets happy and sad. Just like me, she gets annoyed and upset. Just like me, she gets anxious. Just like me, she gets loving. Just like, and the full richness of the human being is disappears into some kind of, oh, it's the cook, or it's the driver, or it's him again. Or it's an unfortunate perception. So, very obvious example, I would imagine, here I am, I come into this room, I'm definitely the odd one out. I imagine you all feel you're the odd one out, but I must be the oddest of the odd ones out. And I'm sitting right in the centre, right? Oddball sitting in centre. He's the one who gets to do all the talking, tells us where. So clearly this is some kind of figure, public figure, and probably authority, big male authority figure comes in, sits, and everybody listens to what he says. Yeah. And then what happens with that? They're kind of expected, everything he's going to say is going to be absolutely wonderful and truthful, or who does he think he is? depending on our relationship to authority figures. I've been an abbot for 22 years, abbot of a monastery, which is certainly an authority figure, an authority position. And I found it extremely uncomfortable from a personal point of view, because you can never get off the throne. Look, I'm only the abbot as long as I, for this half an hour, then I'll get off, just little old me. And still the sense of, moves his ears, and he's this, and he thinks he's throwing his weight around. Everything you say is loaded with authority and power and commanding, and you just kind of end up making the most tentative suggestions. Like, I wonder if you could pass the sugar. He came in here and demanded sugar. Sorry. And of course, I do the same thing, you know. Not as the authority figures, I can see people as people who desperately need me, and they don't. You know, I kind of get what I call mother hen syndrome. You know, when I feel everybody needs to get under my wings. And, you know, think, well, maybe they don't want to be under my wings. Why should they? So, you see, these kind of projections and counter-projections, you see, oh, that's just the sense of, you know, maybe fear or maybe anxiety or maybe just actually quite loving kindness. Yeah, that factor. And my attitude would be, if I have a heart of loving kindness, then I want to help people. And actually, sometimes that's not appropriate. Could you just give me some space? I don't need to be fussed over. Thank you very much. I'm a grown person. You know, get too fussy and so forth. You know? And so it's really, really aware of every, you know, these dhammas as what they are. The energies, the moods, the shifts, the perceptions, and what are called sankharas, which are the activities. It's a difficult word to translate, but it's basically the sort of the do it stuff. And do it stuff can be as simple as, you know, I want to offer my goodwill or something like that, some urge to bring things out. You know? And we can get very habituated into these. And they're quite distinctive. So have you noticed your work? Did you do your mindfulness of work, how that was for you? Work is often a very significant perception and carries all kinds of learned experiences. Well, how we do work. Yeah. I don't know how it's been for you, but it's a really good thing to contemplate. You know, some people find it's an indignity. How dare they? Why should I have to? You know, I got a PhD and here I am scrubbing the toilet. I feel humiliated. You know, it can be like that. There's people who tend towards the high intensity work attitude. So I remember teaching a retreat in a centre, and a couple of people, they have to clean the bathroom. They clean the bathroom like every square centimetre is scrubbed, polished, you know, just working away like... Another person's cleaned the bathroom, they get a rag, I'm going to wipe the mirror, that's fine. That looks good enough to me. And other people are really, really, you know, intense about it. And so we contemplate these formations as they are. And this is not self. These are learned. You have to do something for sure. But just when it gets compulsive, when it gets stuck, yeah, when it gets compulsive and stuck, then it's become taking the center. Yeah. Maybe. You know, I mean, certainly in my experience, personal history and so forth, I'm a kind of do-it person, I guess. I'm a doer. And there's a basic feeling of, if I'm in a situation I'm not doing, I don't feel really comfortable. I feel I'm somehow not pulling my weight or doing something. It's a very... not even that rational, it's just that I'm uncomfortable feeling I should be doing something. So I'm a doer. And I contemplate that, like, what would it be like to not do? Not out of laziness, but just out of questioning my habits. And it can take quite a while. Without feeling guilty. Even when people say, take a rest, Ajahn, take a break, have a rest. I think, while I'm taking a rest, I might as well catch up on that thing I've got to tidy up, do something. While I'm having a rest, I better write to so-and-so, and, easily to do. So it takes quite alternative practice, just what it's like to not do. Not out of laziness, but out of challenging these perceptions and volitions that have become myself, who I am. And that's not true. That's an activity, not an entity. It's not who I am. It's an activity that gets compulsive, habituated. As you probably recognize, most of us find it extremely difficult probably not to do breathing. Right? I was breathing fine until I had to be mindful of it. Then there was a whole system of how to do it, to get it right. Oh my goodness, there's all these steps and stages to do mindfulness. Right, this is really this is the path to awakening, samadhi. This is really, really important. So up comes the do it signal. If it's important, I've got to do it and get good at it. And the breathing just starts to get really uncomfortable and tight. All the energies just contract around it. You don't want to do it anymore. You never want to breathe again. Because you do mindfulness of it. And it's so difficult. So look, just have a guess. Do you think you're breathing or not? Don't get too close to this topic, you know. Just leave it in the back of your mind somewhere that you might be breathing. And occasionally just check it out. to get the system to into something is just open the miracle that things come in and move and change. And nobody's saying whether I'm any good at it or not, apart from this thing in my head. You know, what would it be like to be away from that judge? Yeah. What would it be like to not have that judge in your head telling you whether you're a good enough mother, good enough meditator, good enough manager, good enough wife, good enough daughter, good enough anything, you know. There wasn't something saying, could do better, red line. Just say, I'm just this is as good as it can be now. I'm only as good as I can be now. Maybe next minute might change, but I'm only as wise as I can be right now. And if I'm trying to be wiser than I can be, I'm going to lose balance. So I'll just be as wise as I can be right now, and okay, and just keep checking when things get tight or compulsive or unwholesome. I'll own up to it and check it out. So no strategies. Yeah. I live without a strategizing and accounting. So this is the whole freeing up. You might say, well, that sounds a pretty sloppy, irresponsible way to live. Well, look at it this way. Do you want to live in a law court? Or would you like to play? Okay. And, you know, because if that openness, which isn't strategizing, it's not asleep. It's because it's not strategizing, it's attuned. And therefore, just wait a minute. Just a bit impulsive there. It's actually pretty much on the ball. Pretty much on the ball. We might lose it a little bit, but you don't lose it far if you're really on the ball, because you don't have a plan, you don't have a strategy, you don't have an idea who you are. Therefore, you have to be very wakeful. Yeah. And we lose this. Well, it was interesting reading a traffic experiment where it was in the Netherlands. We had a very large roundabout. They call them roundabouts in South Africa, kind of rotary thing, where there's traffic going through and there's signs and traffic lights and chevrons and speed limits and this kind of stuff all over the place, directing people to this way, that way. And it was a regular traffic hazard. People were always crashing at this traffic hazard. They put more signs up, go slower, look out, look left, look right. What happens? We take all the signs away. All the signs, all the speed, everything. No speed limit, no signs, no traffic lights, just get rid of it all. And people got to it, they didn't know what the hell to do. So they had to drive really, really carefully. And look where the other cars were going. And the accident rate dropped because people had to be wakeful. And it's an interesting experiment, isn't it? Yeah. Like what it takes when we don't take things for granted, when things aren't fixed, we don't really know who we are and whether we can, so we have to be pretty wakeful and just keep winging it, you know. To me, this is a source of delight and a way to live. And of course, you know, in that we recognize, we learn from the bumps and the crashes and the oops, too fast, too slow, got hoodwinked there. This is how we learn about the obstructions. And the center remains light and poised and free from the cramping effect of guilt, anxiety, getting it wrong, my fault, her fault, my father's fault, everybody's fault, or whatever. We're free from that. It's just like, you know, this is a very sensitive experience, being a human, and a very open and a very easily affected experience. Let's just drive carefully. And this is really what I find with the realizations of the openness and the fluency and the non-fixity of the conditioned realm. You don't take a position within it, and that leads to the freedom of the heart. So contemplate, this is my encouragement, contemplate what seems solid for you, what seems, who you seem to be, who you carry in your heart, how real, how true, not just how does it feel, and how tightly gripped is that, and how convincing is it? This is what you want to check out for your own welfare and happiness. And you can explore it, perceptions, feelings, like this.